Greetings and welcome to the second broadcast of Toward the Light, a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics. You're welcome to ring in to this broadcast if you have got questions, and the phone number is 888-268-4313. Again, that is 888-268-4313. I am your host, Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and you're welcome to visit my website at towardthelight.org. It is because of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, IANS, that I'm even able to come forth and share with the world that I am indeed a near-death experiencer. I'd like to encourage you to visit their website at IANDS.org. And I also would like to encourage people to consider becoming a member of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. You do not have to be an experiencer to join, just have an interest in the subject. You can be a researcher, a caregiver, someone who is related to or who's got a friend who's had a near-death experience. Anyone is welcome to join the International Association for Near-Death Studies. I am very pleased to welcome as my guest this evening someone who was a former president of IANS and also himself a near-death experiencer. Welcome, Bill Taylor. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Juliet. Good evening. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it is a pleasure to have you with us. And I got some news that you've got some fans who are already going to be tuning in and listening, and they're really interested to hear about your near-death experience. But what I want to do first, Bill, is ask you to tell us a bit about your connection with IANS, how you came upon IANS, and then what led you to becoming president of IANS. And, of course, that was, I think, shortly after I joined IANS. I joined in 1997. I'm a latecomer, I admit, but that is when I found out about IANS. And as soon as I did, boy, I just jumped right in and became a member and have been a member ever since. So please tell us a bit about your background with IANS, will you?
Sure, Juliet. I guess I had my NDE in 1979, and not knowing even the term near-death experience or never heard of International Association Near-Death Studies, one event that happened was there was an Omega catalog that appeared on my nightstand. I never ordered it, but there it was. And opening that, came upon a class taught by Sophie Burnham on angels. And there's something in my experience that angels had a lot to do with it. So in any event, I knew I needed to go take this class. So I went up to Rhinebeck, New York, and just had a wonderful weekend sitting around with about 50 or 60 people sharing angel stories and events in our lives. And it was that time that Sophie said, it sounds like you've had a near-death experience and you might be very interested in getting in touch with the International Association of Near-Death Studies. So I did. That was back in 93, I guess. I had the experience in 79, but it wasn't until 93 that I went to New York. And that began my association with IANS. I attended the conference that was that year. It was in St. Louis. I knew no one there. I didn't know anything about the organization or had no one to go with me. So I think those journeys that we make sort of on our own, or at least where we're the explorer, just some of the richest journeys in our lives. In any event, I went to St. Louis and for the first time was able to talk with other experiencers. I joined IANS and been to every conference since. It was in 2000, I guess I joined the board I guess it was in 97 or 98 when I joined the IANS board, and then in 2000 to 2003 I was president. We had the conferences while I was president. There was a conference in Seattle, and then we had one in Hawaii while I was president. So that's sort of my introduction into IONS. For those people who don't know, IONS was founded or really began back in 1977, and it publishes two quarterlies, Vital Signs, which is a quarterly newsletter, and the Journal of Near-Death Studies, which is a professional journal. This affords professional juried articles to be published. Oftentimes, it's very difficult to get journal articles of a professional nature published in professional medical journals. But they support ongoing research and education and sponsor local support groups. They conduct an annual conference. A number of the people on the board are professionals themselves. There are near-death experiencers on the board, but they're also doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists. There are a number of folks, nurses and so forth, who are on the board and who guide the association.
Yeah, Debbie James is one of them, and then Dionne Corcoran, who was the president before you became president, and she's back on the board. And we've got such a wonderful, diverse group of people on the board as well as in the organization itself. And I think it's quite interesting to note the fact that there are so many of us who had NDEs in the 70s. I had my big NDE, a huge NDE, it was 1975 crossing over into 76 because I lapsed into a coma on Boxing Day of 75, which was 26 December, and then lost my vital signs on 2nd February, which happens to be my birthday. So between being in a coma for over 5 weeks and losing my vital signs, it was a pretty tremendous journey, as it were. But then I also had NDEs as a child and a couple of others that weren't quite so profound as far as the experience and the transcendent experiences that we call that type of near-death experience. PMH Atwater had her three near-death experiences in 1977. So it's interesting that a lot of us had NDEs, or what I prefer to call an eternal life experience, because actually death is an afterthought if it even occurs at all. I never thought about, oh, I'm dead, because the truth is we don't die. We transition, we shift into another dimension, another realm, another frequency. And last week when I was talking to PMH, she was using the analogy of rollover when she was describing the Mayan and Aztec calendars. Instead of being linear like the Gregorian calendar is, they actually roll over. And I said, you know, I really like that word because that's what I think of with an NDE or just when somebody dies. We don't actually die. We just roll over into a new state of being. So it's really profound to realize that people found out about IONS quite a long time after the fact. I remember talking to John Audette, who was one of the founders of IONS, as well as Bruce Grayson, Kenneth Ring, and Michael Sabin. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Yes, Sabin.
And it was so nice to talk to John Audette at our 2004 IONS conference in Chicago, Illinois, and just really having to extend my deepest thanks and gratitude to him and for IONS, because, again, it's because of IONS that I was able to come out of the closet, as it were, and say, yes, I've had near-death experiences and even feel a sense of pride about it because of how transformative it is and how it is this information is going to help so many people, people that we don't even realize that we are reaching. So this is very, very special that IANS does exist. And again, the website is IANDS.org. I really want to encourage my listeners to please visit the IANS website, become a member, and help spread the word because there's so much information to be had. The website is really content-rich. There's lots of lectures that have been recorded, and now actually some of the lectures from conferences can be downloaded. And then, of course, our quarterly newsletter, Vital Signs, and then, of course, the scholarly journal, the Journal of Near-Death Studies. Bill, would you like to tell us a bit about your near-death experience?
Yeah, I'd love to share it. Really, the I think it's attending a conference or talking with others or being at one of the local groups, which again are on the IANS website, is a place where people can go and feel safe to share their experience.
And I should interject that I am also a facilitator of the Friends of IANS, and I facilitate the support and discussion group in Nashville, Tennessee. They do exist all over the world, and you can find them, again, on the IANS website. But also I would like to encourage people, if you're interested in such a discussion and interest group, to start your own interest group, but you do need to be a member of IANS in order to start a Friends of IANS discussion and support group, again, IANDS.org. And you also facilitate an FOI group, don't
yeah,
you, Bill?
Yeah, right, the group in Maryland.
In Maryland, okay.
And we've been meeting about 95 is when we started.
Wonderful.
Coming back out of that conference in St. Louis, it was just really, for me, I really wanted a group where we could continue talking and meeting others who'd had such an experience. There's something about being in a group or talking with someone and looking. I remember searching for those particular events that happened to me and my indie. Did anybody else experience this kind of a thing? And it's very validating when you find someone who says, yes, that happened to me. Then you can say, well, I'm not alone, and somebody else knows what went on.
That's the big question, isn't it? I know. I went to that myself, and this is why this type of thing is so important, is to be able to have these groups to connect with fellow experiencers and to realize not only are we not alone, but we're not crazy.
Right.
We're quite sound, as a matter of fact, and probably even more sound than most people.
Right. Well, this is really great that this radio show or internet radio, which is a miracle to me, can take place, and so that people who are on the internet, they can be on the internet around the world. It doesn't rely on radio waves to make the connection, and just to realize that there are other people who've had this experience. I know in the movies the NDE has been publicized greatly, and now near-death experience is a household word. But my experience happened in 1979, as I said, and back then Raymond Moody's book came out in 75, and Life After Life was the title of his book, and in that book is his definition or coined the term near-death experience. And it just sort of collectively put together the characteristics of a near-death experience. My first awareness of what it might have been was in a book called Chop Wood, Carry Water. And in there was an excerpt of one of Ken Ring's books. And when I read that, it was just a real eye-opener. It was like, wow, somebody else knows what this is all about. And it was very validating for me that I wasn't alone. But I had a cardiac arrest in 1979. It was in March, same month as we are now. It was 27 years ago. My cardiologist is willing to talk about it a little bit more than he used to, but I've known him now for these 27 years. He said, we don't really know what happened in your case. It wasn't a heart attack. It was what they call a complete heart block. The nerve bundle in the heart, there's a branch point, what they call the bundle branch. And for some reason, he says, the best thing we can describe is that perhaps a virus got into that nerve bundle and stopped conduction in the heart. A cardiac arrest is not a painful thing. It's not like a heart attack where muscle tissue is dying. It's more like a light switch. When somebody flicks the light switch, your heart stops. And immediately you black out and other organs start to shut down. The heart, though, was some conduction was going on in, of the nerves, and so the heart would beat. It would beat erratically, and blood pressure when we got to the hospital was like 50 over 40. And so a lot of coincidences occurred there. Nobody seemed to know what was going on with me. The cardiologist who really saved my life, he said I was at a meeting late at the hospital that night, and he said I was on my way home, and he said I never walked through the ER on my way home, but for some reason that night I did. And they grabbed him and said, can you take a look at this? We don't know what to do here. And I remember somebody leaning over the bed and started to give orders and do this, do that. So they put a wire in my arm and threaded the wire down into the heart, and then put an external pacemaker on my arm to keep the heart beating or to restore the normal rhythm. And he said, well, this is in the local county hospital here in Maryland. And he said, I have to keep turning turning some knob up, a voltage or something, to get it to work. And he said, we've only got two more notches to go. I think we better go up to Hopkins in Baltimore. I remember when he said that, I thought, I really don't want to ride in the ambulance alone. And his next words were, I've never ridden in the ambulance with a patient before, but in your case, I'll go along because I know how to adjust this pacemaker.
Well, talk about some telepathy instantaneously then. That's wonderful.
It really is amazing. And I know my ex-wife and brother-in-law had driven me up to the hospital. And when I recovered or when I came home, they said, well, when we took you into the ER, maybe you don't remember, but you looked at us and you said, everything's going to be okay. You can go home now. And I do remember knowing that everything was going to be all right, whether or not I made it or not. I had a feeling that I was going to be okay, and everybody else was as well. I was in Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore for 2 weeks in the ICU, and then another 2 weeks on the floor. And it's just the first week in ICU, I really don't have much memory. I know that I was in and out of consciousness a lot. I coded three times while in the ICU. I had a seizure. I do remember seeing them standing above my head in one. You kind of black in and out when your heart's not working well. And I remember seeing the people standing above you with the device that shocks your heart into starting it again, and a little bit frightened that, gee, I'd rather not be alert when that's happening. I didn't have some experiences that people have of, at least I don't recall, of floating out of the body at the ceiling and looking down on the body. And I know I would be concerned about that. Gee, I really didn't have an NDE because I didn't have that experience. and I also didn't have an experience of a tunnel, or I don't remember that. And
may I add something to that? Because it's very interesting. Number one, I also did not hover over my body. Basically, I could have cared less about the body for some reason. Mm-hmm. I just went away. And I also never experienced a tunnel.
Right,
and
only
PMH
about a...
Yeah. Atwater pointed out that most NDEs do not experience the tunnel. And unfortunately, and it could be with some of Raymond Moody's work, I'm not sure, but, you know, we started to give a stereotypical sort of analogy of what constitutes an NDE, hovering over the body, going through a tunnel, and so forth, yet so many of those don't have that experience. I went way far and away from my body, and in fact was not even conscious of the physical body or being in the ICU unit, which was over 5 weeks. And what was interesting is that the woman next to me was also in a deep, third stage coma, I believe is what they call it, which is considered irreversible. And yet I had communion with her whilst on the other side. And another thing I'll quickly point out is that my friend Peter Sharkey, he's here in Nashville. He is the one who produced the film Life After Life based on Raymond Moody's book. And I am going to have copies of the video for sale that people can order through my website, but also Ian's will also be able to get copies too, I'm sure. But go ahead. I just wanted to interject that because it is a rather important thing. I'm trying to sort of help people realize that there's a lot more to the NDE, or again, what I prefer to call eternal life experience, than just hovering over a body, over one's body, or going through a tunnel and what have you. So go ahead, Bill.
No, that you're right, Juliet. The it is important, I think, because people think, well, I didn't have that tunnel experience, and therefore it wasn't this kind of an experience.
Yeah, and they'll invalidate themselves.
Yeah.
Exactly.
As I understand it, only about a third or less of the people who have these really have that tunnel experience.
I think PMH said something to the effect of 5%, and I remember at our 2004 conference when, bless him, Dr. Peter Finnick was giving his lecture, and he's actually going to be on my show, so stay tuned.
Good.
We're going to get him booked because he actually validates the near-death experience, and he refers to cardiac arrests and heart attacks quite a bit, and so does Dr. Pim van Lommel. So I am going to also approach him to be on the show because this is really, really important. There are so many things that happen, and they point out that the NDE actually happens when there is a total flatline of the heart, of the brain, everything. So and there are a number of different types of near-death experiences. I've got a friend in Maine. When I was up there, he came to our FOI meetings up in Portland, and he did not even remember his near-death experience that he had as a child, but as a result of reading PMH Atwater's book called The New Children and the Near-Death Experience, and also getting a session with me because I'm a clairvoyant and a medium, all of a sudden he gained total recall of his NDE. He was able to remember the entities that he encountered on the other side. He was able to draw them. It's just amazing. So I think that even if people do not remember the details of their NDEs, take heart, because you can go through certain experiences like getting a reading, reading material, talking to other people, having dreams, all of a sudden you are going to have recall of your experience. And maybe just by listening you know, to you, Bill, also people will start to be reminded of an experience of,
yeah.
Oh, this is familiar. So go ahead.
Yeah,
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I think that's an important thing to point out because when I was in the hospital for that month I was there, I really knew something had happened, but I really wasn't even able to put it into words. And it wasn't until I was home that I began to almost recall things, or things would tend to come back in memory. And when we're walking the dog one time down the road with my ex-wife, we were married at the time, but we were divorced later. But walking the dog down the road, I said to her, I said, you know, I know something more than what I knew when I went in, and I don't understand what this is all about. But at one time, I saw how all of this worked, and I understand the mechanism behind the universe, and everything is happening the way it's supposed to happen. I saw that, and I saw how everything was connected to everything else. And part of my it took many years for those pieces to come back. What I found when it came back and when I was able to put it into a story, again, I didn't have that. I don't remember a tunnel experience, although I'll add a footnote to that. A friend in Albuquerque who's written a book, he believes, and I do too, really, that everybody does go through a tunnel, but some of us may go through so quickly we don't linger there, and other people may linger in that tunnel, may meet loved ones and may have other experiences, see the sides of the tunnel or the light at the end and things like that. But like you, Juliet, maybe we went through so fast, we just didn't even stop to look.
Well, you know, I'm really lost because I have been looking forever. Oh, and I can't find it. I still can't find it. But I read an article in the Journal of Near-Death Studies, and I think it was in an issue in 1999 or 1998. That's what I can't remember. I've just been digging through them because somebody actually wrote about people who go through the tunnel versus people who don't. He was explaining something to the effect that when people are abruptly removed from their bodies, like, for example, accident, cardiac arrest, what have you, that those are the ones who go through the tunnel. And he actually included diagrams, and I wish to heck that I could find this article so that I could refer to it again, because, of course, he was able to explain it so well. And then he said that people who have a more gradual crossing over are not likely to go through the tunnel. And again,
that's,
it's sort of like when you're jerked out all of a sudden, you just go whoop, through this tunnel, and it's very fast. And me, because I was dying of cancer and then went into a coma and had a glorious transcendent experience, you know, there was never the tunnel either way, going or coming. So it's kind of interesting what you're saying, that you feel that perhaps everybody does, but this is something worth probing into and investigating. And again, I wish I could find that article in the Journal of Near-Death Studies.
Well, a good place for the ad for the index to the journal that IANS produced with Jan Holden's support and encouragement. She was really sort of the author of that. But yeah, the tunnel is really an interesting phenomena. I personally sort of think, in a mechanical sense, that the tunnel is really that link between the dimensions. And,
yes.
And we really have to go through that to get in that dimension. Let me backtrack just a little bit, because I've really not described it very much, but I think it's interesting to describe the physical act, if you will, or the physical process. Or the feelings behind actually dying. And I remember when I felt and I'm sure other people have felt this too, your energy is so down, you're so weak, and yet you can still feel energy draining from your body. And I remember almost like my hand, I would like put it to my chest as if to say, I just want to hold that life force in me. And I would try to do that more and more, and yet weaker and weaker. I remember being so weak that I knew I could open my eyes, and yet I knew if I opened them, I might not have, that might be the last energy I had, would just be to open my eyes. So I would lay in the ER or in the intensive care, and I would keep my eyes closed because it takes so much energy to process the scenes that you see. And I remember even as the energy would drain farther from me, even your hearing, I remember I could hear people talking, but to process their words took energy, and I didn't have any energy. And as it would gradually drain out, it was a little bit fearful. I didn't know what was on the other side. I didn't know if I died or not, or if I lived on. And really that fear, as that energy drained, it got to the point where I could not stop the drain. It kept on going. It was like water in a sieve, and the energy would just leave regardless of what I could do. And finally, boom, it left. And I remember just feeling, it's as if, how would you describe it even? It's almost like when something happens, you spill milk or something like that. For a minute there, it's like a disbelief. Oh, it's happening, but boom, it's gone, and you can't do anything about it. And you just turn over, you just release it, I guess is what you call. And finally, when you release it, then was the real surprise to me, like you, Juliet, I found myself way, way out in space. And I found myself looking back on everything. Everything was in front of me, the stars, the planets, all of this was in front of me. And yet nothing was behind me. It was just nice dark behind me. But in front of me was the universe. And my initial reaction was, I'm still alive. How is it possible that I'm out here looking upon all this and I'm not dead? I have no more pain. I'm just looking out and seeing how all this is, and was very surprised, absolutely amazed.
And did you feel that upsurge of energy, like all of a sudden, oh, I'm free, I'm light?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I could see how everything in the universe was tied to everything else.
Exactly.
It was as if there's this big fishnet of web of stuff going between everything to everything else. It wasn't physical stuff, but I don't know what I was seeing. Maybe energy channels between everything.
That's the important thing to make a note of, too, this web, because the web is the is what enables all of us to connect interdimensionally. And, you know, I think it's actually the sacred and the grander form of what the Internet imitates, really. And PMH talks about that in her book, Beyond the Indigo Children, The New Children and the Coming of the Fifth World, this web where everybody can just communicate with one another telepathically, be aware of the multidimensional aspects of our being, because we do live in other dimensions simultaneously to this one. And this web, everyone, you are going to be hearing web a lot more. And we're not talking about the Internet right now. We're talking about something far more significant. But this is really something that I think over and over and over again, we are proving the interconnectedness of all things, because I experienced that too. I experienced total peace, total knowing, total trust that everything was unfolding and evolving exactly the way it should, that everything is being taken care of, how everything has intelligence and life. Everything is energy. And energy cannot be destroyed. It is simply rearranged. So this is great, Bill. I'm so excited that you're talking about this because you're reminding me so much about my experiences too. Go ahead. This is delightful.
Well, Juliet, this energy, I mean, over the years and really looking at it and what it is to me, it's just love energy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And really, I guess let me not get off track too much, but that was probably the main thing that occurred was really this vision of what the universe is all about. And like you say, it's an all knowing. Whatever you wanted to know, was just there. It was, almost before you asked the question, the knowledge is inside you somehow.
It was absolutely instantaneous.
Right. Just a miracle of knowledge. I know, when I came back, you know, I'd try to tell people this, and I think another thing for people to, perhaps an important thing for people to understand is I would come back when I came back, or we talk about coming back here, when I was back home again, and the family would be over, I would try to talk about it, with my family. And I found that the family really didn't want to hear it. And it wasn't till after reading, P.M.H. Atwater's book, Coming Back to Life. That was one of the first books I read. That I understood that this is very common, that close friends and relatives may not want to hear that story. So it was very discouraging. It was a kick in the face. It was like I thought when I was in the hospital, I remembered thinking, they will be so happy to know that when you die, you really don't die.
That's what I felt too, and it was just so heartbreaking when, like, for example, I told a friend about this tremendous journey that I had been on, because of course at that time I had no idea about the term near-death experience, but I knew that I had died, or that my body had died, let me rephrase that my body had died, and she said, oh no, you just hallucinated. And you know, she was one of those fundamentalist-type Christians that believed that everybody absolutely died, and only when Jesus comes back, yada, yada, you know, to quicken the dead and all of that. And it's just, it's not accurate. But it was strange that what she was taught through a religion, she felt like she could counter what I had experienced. And so, and then also when I had said something to a doctor, there were literally half a dozen doctors on my case. One was a woman, I remember, and she was just an absolute gem. But this one male doctor, I had said something, I had alluded to the fact that I had had this experience, and he said, oh, I think you need psychiatric evaluation. And I said, oh, no, I think you do. But consequently, I shut down. And again, it wasn't until, you know, almost 20 years later when I found out about IAMS and I said, oh, goodness me, there's an organization with fellow experiences. Wow. So, you know, I just jumped right in it, and it has just been a tremendous transformative experience for me to be able to be a part of IANS, to connect with other experiences, because, you know, the subject of death has been a stigma since time immemorial. And really, it is our job, that's why we were sent back, to help remove the stigma about death, because death just isn't so. It just really isn't so. And I like the Bavarian proverb that says, at birth, babies die. At death, we understand why. Mm. It's tough coming into this plane, and thank you very much. I can't wait to go home. But now, you know, I'm hoping that with this work, we can really come out and just declare and proclaim our experiences and have people find comfort in it instead of trying to shut down or go into denial. Because, again, people need to know that death is an illusion. It doesn't exist at all.
It's really remarkable. I remember I thought, well, I'll spend some time and, you know, and see what I challenged myself. And I said, well, if you could tell, if you only had one thing to tell someone, a stranger walks up, and you have an opportunity to say something to that person, what would you say to them? What one thing would you say to them? And it took a while to develop. Well, the thing I think I would say to them would be that when you die, you do not die. You know, and I know this. And let them, and then they go away. Okay. And that I thought would be the most beneficial thing I could say. Of course, then I challenged myself, well, what's the, if you only had two things and kept on going. But I think there's some, let me just add a little part to my story is when I got back in the hospital, I felt that there was some bargaining that went on. And I, for years and years, I did not understand what this bargaining was about. And gradually pieces came back to me. And I think what happened was, or as best I can describe, I was given an option as to whether to come back or not. And given the option by a light being, if you will. I don't have much of a memory of a light being, but there was some option. And it was my choice as to whether to come back. But before I made my choice, I was told my mother and father were alive and actually were at the hospital in the later stages. And I was told before I make my choice, put your hand on your mother's heart and feel what you're not coming back would mean to her. Right? And also the being said, put your hand on my heart. And I liken this being to Jesus, but this being didn't have a sign hanging around his or her neck. It was just, I just call it a sort of an omniscient being. And when I did that, I also saw that there's really a reason that we're here, and we need to complete our mission, and we need to do that. And so I needed to come back for not only for my mother's sake as well as for my own sake. So that was another part of my story. And that mystery is still a little bit there as to what is it that I'm here for and what do we do? Of the top three things that I would tell people, one is when you die, you do not die. And people really need to sit with that and not just sit with them as words, but there's a reason for the fact that we feel we're separate here, and I understand that. But anyhow, the second thing I would tell people is that there really is, and I'm not sure the best words, there really is a divine presence. There really is a divine energy, if you will, in heaven. I call it heaven. And the third thing is, and the third thing, like you, Juliet, I mean, we know so well, that love is really the fabric of the universe.
Oh, it absolutely is. And the really special thing about all of this is the fact that we've been there. We've been able to experience firsthand this light, this divinity, this love.
And we've been allowed to come back with that memory.
Yes.
It's absolutely amazing.
And even memories from our experiences continue to come back.
Right.
You know, even to this day, I am still remembering more things. And it was, as I shared with PMH Atwater last week, I said it was as a result of reading your book, The New Children and the Near-Death Experience, that I was able to remember a lot of things that I went through as a child and why I was the way I was as a child. And she said, remember, Juliet, you're an experiencer. And I thought, whew, yes, indeed. And so I feel this sense of authority because I am an experiencer. We're not just theorizing here. We're not hypothesizing. We're saying we've been there. This is what we've experienced.
Yeah, we've been there, and not meaning to sound arrogant, we know something.
Exactly.
And we're just trying to spread that word and just trying to get that information out to people who can use it in their lives and who can use it to make decisions. You know, I think there's an evolution process going on here, and we're just a little part of that. But that little part, I think, is very important to help speed up this evolution process, this dimensional shift that people talk about, that the Earth is going through.
Oh, it's tremendous. And I think we're all being little searchlights, you know, just beaming up into the sky and alerting the world. There are some tremendously wonderful things, and there indeed is good news. And this, to me, is, I believe, the truest sense of the word to be born again, because we literally have crossed over and then have come back to this plane and been quickened in a huge way, as PMH says, spirit shift, brain shift. You know, we're not the same as we were before crossing over to the other side. And we did experience that light and that love first time, too. Oh, and I remember just crying my eyes out when... It was kind of funny, because when I came back into this plane, I was still seeing and experiencing that light being.
Mm-hmm.
And still, you know, it's like talking to you right now. We were having this wonderful conversation, and it was showing me all of these wonderful things and these truths. And then when I guess, finally was reduced to this lower vibrational frequency and could no longer see that light being, oh, I was heartbroken. I just cried like you wouldn't believe. But the thing that I always need to remember, because I was constantly being reassured, we are always with you. You are never alone. Nobody is ever alone, even though we might feel like we're alone. And it's only because right now we have been reduced to this low vibrational frequency again that we can't always perceive this light and this love that is still surrounding us at any given moment. And it is really tremendous to think about this, and I do keep reminding myself, but I think as more and more of us, here we are from all different walks of life, from different countries, different ages, what have you, and look at this similar thread of information that is coming through that bespeaks the same information, this love, no matter what, this love is there. It is enveloping us.
Yeah, we're all loved so much. I don't think in this dimension, in this what I call this time-space dimension.
Yes, exactly.
It's difficult, I think, for us to really feel that love. And yet when you're on the other side, really, we talked about the tunnel as being not one of the most common characteristics, but I think the most common characteristic is the intense feelings of love that people feel on the other side.
It's so very apparent, isn't it?
No
question whatsoever.
Right. You're surrounded by love that does not exist in here. You're accepted. You're whatever you've done, whatever you are, you're just welcomed and accepted and loved. It's There are not words to describe it.
And that was something I was shown during my NDE, too, when I saw these sort of gray entities, and I knew that they were, beings who, when they had been incarnated on the physical plane, on this earth plane, that they had done atrocities, you know, and maybe we could say somebody like Hitler, for example, he's the most popular example, excuse me, but as I was observing them, I felt so much compassion for them, and I wanted to see them heal and be all right, and what was so beautiful is that I was reassured in an instant that these beings would indeed be all right, that they too would return to the light, because every being does without exception. And so it doesn't matter what somebody does, they are still loved. Now, when someone does something that is atrocious, of course they're going to have to pay for it. It's not like you get away scot-free, but there's no punishing entity on the other side is going to say, down you go, you're going to burn forever, because I just don't see that as even being possible. When love is everywhere,
right,
there is no such thing as being separated from the light source, ever.
Well, yeah, I remember coming back and too, thinking about that, and I would tell people, well, while I was there, it's the only natural thing you can do. I would just extend my love to all these other spirits.
Exactly. It's so natural to do it, isn't it?
It is. Well, that's because that's all we are.
Yeah.
Really, all we are is really just intense, a very intense beam or light of love. And I would tell people that I would do that. And I remember one time someone said, well, how would you extend your love to, say, a bank robber or, for that matter, a murderer? And I thought, well, who would, you know, your example of Hitler. And so I remember saying to people, well, even if there were Hitler's spirit was there, I would still extend my love to that spirit. And I was really rebuffed. And so for a couple of years, I stopped saying that. And then I thought, well, no, that's not right, because I would do that. And that's what you would do.
And love is what heals them. And
well, there were some other reasons I came up with there in earthly terms. One is that as a spirit extending love to another spirit, one, I am not the judge of that other spirit.
Exactly.
And the only thing I can do is extend love. And the second thing is, in heaven, no spirit has power over another. So there was no fear there. Where there's such intense love, there's no fear. So I was not at all fearful of whatever these other spirits had done. That wasn't really my concern. I would just extend my love to them.
I remember that, too. I remember experiencing absolutely no fear.
No fear.
People can imagine that. Wow. What a glorious state to be in. And even after I had come back to this plane, I was free of fear for quite a while, but then finally, I'm sorry to admit, it did set in again. But it's nice to talk about this because it helps remind us. It sort of helps to put us back into that space where we can re-experience the fearlessness and the love and the trust and the knowing and all of this. And it is so tremendous. Now, we've just got a couple of moments, I believe, and then we're going to have to sign off. But share with us just a little bit more in closing, Bill, what you would like to tell our listeners.
Well, what would be interesting, if you want to at another time, I really, from what I've learned from that experience, I kind of have my own theory as to how all this works, but this, call it God energy, if you will. I really like to refer to it as love energy.
Mm.
And that the universe really is, has been, this time-space dimension that we're in has been created by this love energy for a purpose. And I think I have some, my own explanations, as simple as they are, as to why this love energy did this. And,
Go ahead and share some of it.
Well, let me start, first of all, by... to me, people say, well, we're here to learn, and I agree with that, but I think there's really, in a way, more important reason that we're here. I think we're we're here, and we're there's this veil, if you will, this separation. And this separation has a definite purpose, because we're here to do a creation, that we cannot do in heaven, but that heaven, this love energy needs to know how to handle this infinite variety of situations. And it has to do with love and fear. And I think one of the key things, and we talked about it a little bit, that on the other side, you don't have fear. Pure love energy does not know fear. And I think that's one of the key components to me, the explanations as to the nature of love energy. And it simply comes down, I think, to the fact that love energy, by its very nature, is expansive. And yet, we're taught in Sunday school that love energy or God energy is completely satisfied, lacks nothing, has existed forever. To me, I'm looking and seeing that love energy is expansive by its nature. It is fearlessly expanding, and therefore it can create all different kinds of dimensions, time, space, dimensions, or whatever, to explore and to expand into them. And we're really kind of that leading edge of that expansion. And we're little bits of love energy going out. And now in our separation here, we're going to experience the front line of love energy and fear. And we can make choices. And I think in our choices and in our workings with that, when we go back to heaven, if you will, when we go back home again, we take that experience with us, and that really becomes an expansion then of the Book of Knowledge, or of the knowledge of this front line.
Phil, this is absolutely beautiful, and I want to thank you so much for joining us here, and this has been so tremendous, and I look forward to having a lot more of these discussions, and we'll certainly have you back in future. And I want to send my love and blessings to everyone. I hope you have enjoyed this, and this has been a source of great inspiration and upliftment for you. We will be speaking with you again next week at 8 o'clock p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which is minus 8 hours Greenwich Mean Time. Until then, remember that only love prevails.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.